issue four, I think, is agenda paper 15.
Okay, I think that's me again.
You again, Yemma.
Yep. So this one, agenda paper 15, is on non-cash consideration. It's not uncommon in certain industries for customers to promise consideration in a form other than cash. So, for example, shares or share options. And, of course, that type of consideration, we commonly refer to that as non-cash consideration. The new revenue standard makes it clear that to determine the transaction price for contracts in which a customer promises non-cash consideration, an entity shall measure that non-cash consideration at fair value. However, some stakeholders have suggested that the standard is unclear regarding the date at which the non-cash consideration is measured. There seem to be three views in practice as to when the fair value should be measured, either at contract inception, when the non-cash consideration is received or receivable, or at the earlier of when the non-cash consideration is received, or as the performance obligations, related performance obligation, is satisfied. Stakeholders also have questioned how the constraint on variable consideration should be applied to non-cash considerations in certain fact patterns. Specifically, stakeholders note that the new revenue standard is clear that the constraint applies to variability resulting from reasons other than only the form of the consideration. However, stakeholders have questioned how to apply the constraint when the fair value varies due to both the form of the consideration and for reasons other than the form of consideration. Some believe the constraint should apply to only variability resulting from the form of consideration, whereas others believe that the constraint should apply to both changes resulting from both the form of consideration and for reasons other than the form of consideration. Under the latter, you'd have to basically bifurcate the changes in fair value to determine which have resulted from the form and which have resulted from other than the form of consideration. So our questions for the TRG are simply to get feedback on your views as to when you believe non-cash consideration should be measured, the date at which it should be measured, and how you think the constraint on variable consideration should apply in situations when the fair value may vary for reasons due to both the form of consideration and for reasons other than the form of consideration. And although we have teed these up as two separate issues in the paper, I think for discussion purposes, it would be helpful to talk about them together, because I think, at least here, we've found as you talk through this issue, some of the complexities that arise are really when you try to, you know, think through the combination of those two. So, for example, if you were in the camp of measuring non-cash consideration at contract inception, the answer to the second issue may be a lot easier than if, for example, you chose to measure at a later date. So with that, I'll open it up to the TRG.
Start the discussion here. Allison.
Thank you. All right, I'm really excited to be able to talk about this one. People who know me well know that my background prior to revenue recognition relates to share-based payments. So this was an issue when I first looked at the standard through the exposure draft, and the fatal flaw like jumped out at me like, oh my goodness, what is the measurement date supposed to be? And are they really going to get rid of that nice symmetrical guidance we have for non-employee share accounting here in the U.S.? And it appears that the answer to that is yes, that guidance has gone away. But the question about what is the measurement date still remains. And it's interesting because I have that perspective, I'm kind of a view C person all the way, because I think that it more closely aligns with the symmetrical accounting that I'm used to and familiar with, and I think for shares and options it makes more sense. But that's my bias, because that's where I come from. I think my counterpart over in London or sitting in South Africa today is more of a financial instruments person, so he may share a different perspective in terms of the timing of when he thinks that the measurement ought to occur. And then we hear from folks who maybe aren't share-based payment people, they're not financial instruments people, they're just looking at when should you record the value of an asset on your balance sheet, and should that drive the determination of the measurement date, and it really shouldn't relate to the timing of your performance, it just really should relate to you should have a final measurement when you have the thing and it's time to put it on the balance sheet. So there are, I think, disparate views all over the place. It would be helpful to get further clarification, in particular because just looking at the example 31, unfortunately, paragraph 55-250, there is a last sentence there that says, to determine the transaction price and the amount of revenue recognized, the entity measures the fair value of 100 shares that are received upon completion of each weekly service. Sorry, it's the second to last sentence, actually. And I think people read that sentence a couple of different ways, and it depends on the construction of the sentence leads to the confusion, because you could read that to say that the entity measures the fair value of 100 shares that are received upon completion of each weekly service, which means that's the measurement date, or you could read it just to say that you're just supposed to measure the fair value of 100 shares that happen to be received upon completion of each weekly service. So that's why the question has arisen, and I'm very encouraged to know that perhaps we're going to make some progress on that issue. When it comes to the question on the constraint, you know, I struggled with the idea of separating, or at least it just doesn't seem very practical to try to separate the changes in the value of the consideration due to the form of the consideration versus variability that's happening for other reasons. I think it can be done. The example that you point out in the paper here with the option that has the changing exercise price, I think you certainly can remeasure the value of the option by holding the share price constant and just figuring out what's the fair value incremental change based on a different exercise price. So I think you can do it. It just adds complexity, and it makes you wonder, well, does that really need to be the solution?
So to put you on the spot, mm-hmm. Are you effectively, absent additional guidance, you're finding it hard to say that the standard would preclude any of the potential measurement dates?
Yes.
Okay. Brett?
I think we were in a VUC camp also on the first issue. I thought we felt like that was a fair way to interpret the standard. It achieved the objective, and it seemed like, you know, when it was time to recognize the revenue was when you would want to strike a measurement, unless you had gotten the non-cash consideration earlier, in which case you now own the asset and you were simply just remeasuring asset value. So it seemed like changes in value that occurred after you were entitled to record the revenue and recognize the revenue seemed like they shouldn't be affecting your revenue. That's really to us a subsequent valuation outside of customer revenue. So that led us down to a VUC conclusion. On the second issue, and I guess to me it's sort of a question of to what elements of the consideration do I think the constraint needs to apply? And does it need to apply to the entire arrangement, you know, all the reasons why there might be variability, or just to the aspects of the arrangement that are affected by my own performance? And that led us to more of the kind of the view B, recognizing the complexities there. I think if you read the standard and says, you know, the variability, if it relates to the form of the consideration, that's not in the scope of the standard. And so therefore, as we read that sentence, I can see how you get to a different view there, but it seemed to us that separating the variability into its elements respected the standard. So we were view B.
From your standpoint, it sounds like maybe you think C is clearer in the standard, or are you saying that that's sort of what you think the economics are? Do you think the standard answers it clearly?
We think C gets you to the principles in the standard, I guess. I don't know that's clear in the standard, but
I got you. Mark?
Yeah, I won't add too much to what Allison and Brett said, but we were generally view C, but as Allison pointed out, when we did talk with our colleagues overseas, and I'm sure they're waiting to talk over there, we understand certainly that the other views are not. I mean, view C, we said it generally because that's how we look at it under U.S. GAAP today, and we didn't think things were changing. But I understand B. I'm not sure I would support A, but there are others that do. So I don't think it's clear in the standard.
Alan?
So I'm not exactly sure how to apply any of these related to our industry, and I'll give the following simple example. So this is related to entertainment and media, and we enter into license arrangements. So take, for example, let's use a more international media license as Downton Abbey. So we will take the first five seasons of Downton Abbey, and we will license that to, let's say, a BBC or to a TBS in the United States for the first five seasons. So these are all the rerun seasons. It's already been run the first time. So for the second run, we will get roughly, I'm just going to make up some numbers here, $200 million in cash, and that will be paid over, let's just say, a five-year period. And we will also get an approximate $200 million of advertising time, which would be the barter component, that we will get, that will we get, let's say, two 30-second spots on BBC or two 30-second spots on TBS over the contract period. So the question is, when should we recognize that advertising time that we received in the arrangement? I'd say under current U.S. GAAP, there was an EITF that addressed this issue that said recognize the advertising revenue as you, when we actually don't use it for our own time, we will sell that advertising time to, let's say, a Procter & Gamble. So we will recognize that advertising time as Procter & Gamble buys the advertising time from us. The codification, for some reason, decided not to include that EITF, but that's a totally separate issue. And we had spoken to the FASB about that at one point in time. I think that was just a miss. But under the potential new guidance, I'm not exactly sure what the accounting would be. Should we, from an entertainment and media perspective, should we be recognizing $400 million of revenue up front because we've licensed the product to the BBC, our performance obligation has been met up front, and it's not an overtime model? And if we do that, if we recognize all 400, we're going to recognize revenue 400. Are we going to set up an asset for 200 as far as the costs, and then recognize and recycle that revenue again when we sell to Procter & Gamble and recognize another 200? So in total, we would have $600 million of revenue. And also the form and substance of these arrangements could obviously change. We're taking, call it the 2 minutes of advertising revenue or a certain time frame of advertising revenue from the BBC or from TBS. We could have structured the arrangements very simply that we just retain 2 minutes of the total advertising time in the arrangement as well. So I'm not exactly sure how A, view A, B, or C fit into how we should be accounting for, I'll call it the barter arrangement or the non-cash arrangement.
Sounds like your issue is broader than the scope of issue, at least issue one, which is when to measure the value. You're getting into more how to timing of recognition in the broader transaction. Is that fair?
I guess part of it as well is how to measure as well, in that if we would receive advertising over, let's say, a three-year period or a five-year period, advertising rates change over time, and so how do you measure it as well?
Gotcha. Others here? Jim.
Just a quick observation. I do think the view C makes sense. I'm not a financial instrument expert, but certainly it seems like the boards addressed the issue when they did business combinations around inception versus when the transaction closed. So VUC seems to be closer to me than any of the other two alternatives. On Alan, on your point, I'm not sure you don't have variable consideration with respect to advertising, which would then be subject to constraint and might get a different answer.
Right. So we did think about, is it variable consideration? I think from the point of, I mean, I would like that answer. But I think from the point of the arrangement with the BBC or the TBS, we entered into an arrangement to get a certain amount of advertising. Yes, the we entered into an arrangement, and so we have we performed our obligation, we delivered the product, and now it's a question of how much is the advertising worth. But we didn't think that was variable. It was just a question of estimating what the total advertising is worth. So I guess we did think about that as well, and if it was variable, I could understand how that could be as well, and we sort of did like that answer as well.
So I guess one view would, at least how you potentially looked at it, is it varies because of the form of the consideration, not because of your performance.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
On that second issue of whether you need to bifurcate the change, my question would be, do investors really care? You know, if they don't, then I think it simplifies it if you don't have to account for it that way.
Hi, this is Rita.
Yes, Rita.
Can you, to that question that was just posed, investors do care? Whether you would be recognizing $400 million on the sale or $200 million would make a pretty big difference, particularly with the marginal profit from it. So,
but that is not this. That's the license paper. The win is not, this is how much, not a win question. A win question is being dealt with.
It is more than just a license. This is a non-cash issue because right now, under current GAAP, we would recognize $200 million upfront of license revenue and $200 million of advertising revenue that we're selling to Procter & Gamble over the contract period. So it was not addressed in the license area. This is a non-cash consideration issue.
But we might end up in the license situation taking the $200 million over time. We might not. That's my point. So if it's meaningful in the separate, we might solve that there. Not
yeah,
here.
But I didn't think we were headed that way.
But I don't know where we're heading. We'll have a meeting. Don't saying. Yeah, your 600-400 is a gross versus net question, right?
It is.
Or are you the agent?
No.
It's not a principal agent type question. It's when you're getting non-cash it happens to be when you're dealing with the interaction that a performance obligation has been delivered already, and you're getting non-cash consideration over a period of time.
Even if it is non-cash consideration.
As you pointed out, you could just retain advertising instead
of
getting it.
Scott, right. Yeah. I think working through that example would be useful for us to think about so we could see the various outcomes and iterations. Scott?
Of the views presented, I prefer view C conceptually, although I note that measuring as performance occurs, if satisfied over time, is really hard. Do you measure it minutely, hourly, daily, weekly, monthly? That's really hard. I think it's the right concept, but I'm not sure we can do it without some practical guidance that says, you know, but you don't have to measure more than quarterly or something. The other thing I'd point out, and the one thing I believe is clear from the standard, is that you measure revenue no later than when you receive the non-cash consideration. I think that's wrong. I think you ought to measure the revenue when you perform. When you receive the consideration, that's when the consideration goes on the books. So if you receive shares up front, and they go on the books as shares. But if you haven't performed anything yet, I'd still wait to have the final measure of revenue until you perform. I think the alternative, conceptually, best answer, is to measure the revenue at contract inception. regardless of when you receive and when you perform. I don't understand why receiving the consideration impacts when you measure the revenue.
It does seem subject to then whatever answer you want. I'll give you the shares after you perform. I get one answer. I give you the shares, and you'll give them back to me if you don't perform.
Or you'll be in breach of contract if you don't perform. We usually don't like timing of payment to impact the amount of revenue unless there's a financing component. Yet, here it is.
Scott, isn't the idea that when you receive them, that's when you can then monetize them and sell them?
Sure.
You can lock it in.
But if you haven't...
So the fact that you hold on to them shouldn't change the revenue, right?
Why? You didn't perform yet.
But you just got shares and you could sell them, or you could... Just the fact that the shares go up or down shouldn't change, right?
Okay, well, then it shouldn't change if you get the shares later either. You should just recognize the amount of revenue based on the share measurement at contract inception.
Do people struggle with the same issue if you're being paid in a foreign currency? Brett?
Yeah, I think we would struggle with the same issue, and that's why I do think when you have receipt of the asset, is to me the right time to measure it, measure what you got, and so I don't struggle with that one. On the second issue, I wanted to come back to a point, which is that if we don't look at, if we say because there's variability for both performance and nature of the consideration, that means if we get to the view that says that you therefore don't apply the constraint, doesn't that mean I have to value no matter what? In other words, I thought that the idea of splitting and saying, well, there's reasons why the constraint applies here because my performance impacts that decision, therefore that aspect of measurement is subject to the model, meaning I potentially would have to hold back revenue recognition because there could be a significant reversal. If the conclusion is I can't separate these two, there's variability for both reasons, where does that lead us? Does that lead us to saying that I don't have to apply the constraint, or I shouldn't apply the constraint, and therefore I have to kind of measure unfettered? Or what's the conclusion if you don't separate, I guess, is the question I would pose.
The view in the paper about not splitting would be then about applying the constraint to the entire arrangement. And that may well, if it's shares, you might have a hard time getting through the traps on variable consideration constraint. Right, I mean, you have no ability to influence the share price, so that's probably going to mean the constraint kicks in. And under that view, once it kicks in for the entire amount of the consideration.
Mm-hmm. So while view A is easier to apply, it could result in some cases in the deferral of revenue.
Okay, thank you. Just wonder if that creates an opportunity for structuring, if you will.
Ian, over to you.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks. Probably four things to say, but I will try to be brief. The first is echoing what I think a lot of people have said. We don't think that it's clear which of approaches A, B, and C the standard requires. We think any of them seem at the moment to be potentially allowed. So some clarity over that would probably be a good thing. I think I've forgotten what two is. I'll do three and four, and then hopefully I'll remember what two is. In terms of the... two is... Just to say, I think quite a few people were sort of leaning towards view C. I think that perhaps I would as well, but I would quite like to understand what a word like receivable might mean in that context. And in particular, if I was applying view C and what was receivable was a variable number of shares that would be determined by performance that hadn't happened yet, then view C starts to seem like quite a bad answer to me. So I think I can see received more than I can see receivable. I think that starts to get potentially confusing. On the question of applying the constraint and whether where you've got variability due to just more than just the form of the consideration, whether you need to bifurcate or whether kind of all of it is taken into account, the paper I don't think says this, but presumably it would be good that whatever is being presented as revenue is the thing that is subject to the constraint versus things that are being stripped out and not reported as revenue wouldn't be subject to the constraint. I assume that's the underlying logic. I guess conceptually bifurcating seems like it might be theoretically better, but it raises all kinds of questions around practicability, possibly very, very serious questions. So I'm not sure I'm attracted to it. And just one final point that I'm not sure if this is allowed because I'm not sure if it's on point, but the question of what is and what is not non-cash consideration seems to me that it could be problematic too. I think I can see that equity shares are almost certainly non-cash consideration. I'm not sure whether a debt instrument is non-cash consideration or whether actually it's just something that's ultimately going to turn into cash and therefore it is cash consideration. So I think there might be some issues around that too.
Yes, well. Thank you. When I first reading this paper, I thought originally regarding the ECUC, I thought the view B should be the answer, because I'm a little bit confusing with the consideration I received. It's confusing, but looking at the example, the website is complete. So that's the point this consideration is recognized. So I think the board's intention was to be consistent as much as possible towards that cash consideration. Then looking at the paragraph 88, and the variable adjustment needs to be done, even after the performance obligation is satisfied. So I think technically, I thought view B makes sense. And considering that issue two for the constraint, I thought technically as well, the view B is a reasonable interpretation. But in both cases, I thought that practically it is very difficult in the issue, first issue and second issue. So, and since it's not clear for when that this cash should be recognized, it's not clear, so I think its qualification might be necessary.
Okay. Christoph. I struggled when reading a paper a bit about what is the non-cash consideration, if it is a right to something. Paragraph 108 calls the receiver, defines the receivable right to receive consideration. But nevertheless, after contract inception, generally, we say, now it's an IFRS 9 topic to take care of that. So why would a right to receive cash be treated differently than a right to get a car? That's why I've got to admit I'm leaning a bit towards A. And in the paper, what is said in paragraph 18, that the fair value of non-cash consideration at contract inception best reflects the value that a customer is willing to exchange for promised goods or services. I like that notion. And I would struggle to explain to analysts or investors that our revenue went down because our share price went down, or the share price of the mother company went down, because it doesn't reflect what I agreed with the customer, nor does it reflect my performance. We've got a lot of other things that are in IFRS 15, where you look at contract inception, and that's why I would lean towards A. Whatever it is, I think we need alignment between this and what is currently with IFRIC about foreign currency with regard to long-term contract, that we got a joint principle for solving both.
Brian.
Christoph made one of my points, which was just to highlight the IFRIC discussion of foreign currency, because I think there was a question asked on the other side. I am unclear what the measurement date is intended to be when I try to work out what would be a sensible principled answer. I think on the one hand, similar to what Christoph was saying, this is fundamentally a transaction price model, and therefore the value at the date you enter into the transaction seems to be telling you something about the terms on which the two parties contracted. On the other hand, it's a performance model, so something more like VC, where you measure the consideration as you perform. You know, I can see the arguments from first principles for either of those approaches, and I'm not sure that the standard is clear as to which of those to apply. I did look at existing IFRS literature, including 631, to see if I was being told absolutely when to measure non-cash consideration at the moment, and I'm not sure that I am told precisely how to do it at the moment, so maybe it's not a completely new question. And I was very interested that there was an example about Downton Abbey introduced. Also, I'd just like to take the opportunity to say that here in the UK, we all live in houses like that, and virtually see the documentary, so thank you.
Well, some of us have got bigger houses than that.
I think our sense is that we would probably be in a VC camp. I think that, to an extent, is consistent with where the Interpretations Committee or the staff paper is headed and the discussion at the previous Interpretations Committee might be, but I echo what others have said, that we need to at least think about the answer to that question, which will be discussed tomorrow as we think about this one. I think our sense is that we would get to VC through the standard, and that we think we could probably do that, and having heard that other people perhaps see some inconsistencies, I think we'd look at it as saying that the key to the standard is recognising revenue when you perform, and that if you haven't yet received the consideration, then it would seem sensible to measure it on the day that you perform, and then changes in the value of your right to the consideration afterwards, for example, changes in foreign currency or changes in credit risk, do not affect revenue. On the other hand, if you've received it in advance and you have an unconditional right to something and you use that unconditional right to sell it, then it seems odd to keep remeasuring that unconditional right even after you've sold it, up to the point that you perform. So I think that would steer us through the standard and the example towards view C. And similarly, I think we would go with view B on the second question. And the standard does seem to say that, understanding that it might be complex in some situations. But I think that's where we would end up.
So, Tony, can I just clarify? If you had a contract where you were providing some services,
mm-hmm.
and unlike the example and the standard, there's a performance condition there. What you do is that each day you're performing, you'd establish essentially how much non-cash consideration you're going to be entitled to. And so that's the amount that you'd effectively recognise. And then you're saying the change in the value of that after that date would obviously not impact mm-hmm. the revenue line. But a change in the amount of the consideration as opposed to its value would obviously then impact the revenue yes. in the subsequent periods.
Yes. Right. Well, I think to the point that...
And that seems to get to Phil's concern a little bit about the interaction with the receivable.
I think this comes to point. There might be a broader question around the interaction of
yeah.
the revenue standard with the financial instruments guidance that's maybe not the subject of this paper, but yes, I think I agree with what you said. I think to the point that Scott made, it could get very complicated if you say you need to do it every day, every hour, every minute.
Yes.
But it seemed to us that's where the principle took you, and that there should then be a practical way of applying that.
Yeah. But practically, people could use averages and approximations
yes.
to achieve that
yeah.
effect, as you would do under IFRS 2.
Yeah.
Okay. Further comments? Andrew.
Just on the variability point, I think that the approximations way is likely to be the right way to do. We do it in foreign exchange at the moment, where we're supposed to use a daily rate, but we don't in practice because we have monthly or quarterly or thereabouts, depending what the volatility is. I think when we looked at this, there were some supports in both view B and view C, but there was a lot of focus on when do you record the asset, because that seemed to be the point at which you record the value, and that would then drive the revenue. There's a little bit of noise around, well, do you have to wait until you've got a receivable, which goes into IFRS 9 or some other kind of asset, or do you get it on the contract asset? On the point of what sort of principle do you apply, I agree that looking at what you would do with foreign currency transactions is probably quite a good one. The other one maybe to think about a bit is for something which is pretty volatile. So maybe just given the events of this week, let's say that 2 months ago I entered into an arrangement to sell goods and services in exchange for a fixed value of Greek government bonds. And now we're in a position where the value of those government bonds has rather fallen through the floor. I'd be very interested in understanding whether I have to wait until I get these and can monetize them, or whether I got them all up front and could have immediately sold them in the market and got my cash. And I think it's that's part of it which perhaps drives the recording of it, which then pulled many of us well away from view A, because we didn't think that view A was one which really worked, because when you started looking at an asset which was volatile in particular, it tended to suggest that view A wasn't where you would want to end up.
It goes back to the first point you made, Andrew, that it's, I think you said when you acquired the asset.
Yeah.
Well, when in your view would that be?
Well, that's where you have the split between B and C, because you could say it's when you've got contract assets. But I'm not sure that's quite right, because at that point you don't necessarily have the entitlement to say, give me that non-cash asset right now. And that's why a number would then focus on view B and say, well, view B is the right way, because it's at the point at which you've either got that non-cash consideration or you can go today and say, give me it. And then that takes away your exposure to risk. And I think part of it was the exposure to risk that people might have.
But Christoph would go the other way and say, at the time you sign the contract, you agree to a value, and if it moves, then that's just a movement in an asset you've already got. And that's the kind of...
Yeah, that's...
You acquired it at the time you signed the contract, in effect, in your argument.
I'm not convinced you've acquired the asset, yeah.
Thinking about what Brian said, do you get many questions around this today? Because Brian is saying it's actually... can't point his hand on specific guidance in IFRS today. Do you get, in practice, many questions around significant non-cash transactions?
We've not had a great rush of questions, I'll be honest. I think it's as with many things, when you have new guidance, people go back and say, well, what if we got that transaction?
But I think Henry's point more was under existing IFRS, do you get many questions? Robert.
I just wanted to make a quick comment about, just think about shorting. So in your example, at contract inception, if you really were sure, why couldn't you just short your Greek bonds right there? And so I think your thought process is interesting, but if you add shorting to your discussion, I think the answer is you're not going to short them until you're sure you're going to get them. So
That's true, but I would view that as a separate transaction, because if I have agreed to take delivery of something volatile, then I can take out a derivative contract to hedge myself. But I would view the hedge as being a separate transaction. It's not part of the revenue transaction, because it's not one with my customer. It's one where I'm going to another counterparty and saying, I want to short these bonds.
Christoph is going to disagree with you.
If I look at what you set the example with, you get a right to receive Greek bonds. Now imagine that right is tradable. Now it's your decision whether you sell the right to the Greek bonds on day one or you keep it until you get the Greek bonds delivered. Would revenue then depend on that decision, and what had that decision to do with a customer transaction?
Okay, and we mustn't let this run on too long, it's quite interesting. Any other comments? On the telephone, are there any comments? No, I don't.
Hi, it's James Luke here, and hi, can you hear me? James,
yep.
Luke?
Yep, go ahead.
Sorry, I don't want to reiterate the points that were raised there, but listening to the conversation has actually been quite interesting, and Alison alluded to it. I think I tend towards view A for the reasons that Scott and Christoph possibly mentioned, but to me the underlying problem is that it's very difficult to pinpoint what the state standard intended or when that measurement date should be for this non-cash consideration. So I would be supportive of any further clarification that could be done, maybe by way of example or in the basis of conclusion.
Okay, thanks, James. Any further on the telephone? Okay, well, Jim, we've got agreement on view A, view B, and view C. You take it from there.
So I heard the same thing. I did hear more of a preference for view C, and I think even those who preferred it, differing views as to whether that was required by the standard or the guidepost in the standard would send you there. But I certainly heard, particularly Ian in the discussion over there, support for both view A and view B as being consistent with the standard. And I think summed up well by saying it's difficult to pinpoint in the standard what the standard intended. I don't know if it certainly wasn't unanimous, but I think a fair summation of views that absent additional guidance in this arena, it seems that views A through C might take hold in practice. That certainly isn't what we have in U.S. practice today. We do have a clearer answer that tends to be closer to view C, so I think that's feedback we need to take and consider what to do with. Alan, I also take your example, which I think is slightly broader than the measure.